When I was young, I thought the more difficult book, the better. I did not want to be led to where and what I had already known, to be guided in a language with words that seldom required a dictionary. At 15, I saw a beautiful older woman whom I had a giant crush on, sitting on a park bench and reading as if nothing else in the world had mattered. I was ashamed of my lustful thoughts and expected her to have read them in my stare. She finally noticed me and called me over and asked if I'd like to read. Of course, I said, nervously beginning to name a few books I had loved. Oh, those are good books, she said. You're my son's friend, aren't you? Yes, I am, I said. Not mentioning that we disliked each other, that he called me Four Eyes and a fruity bookworm. I have other books you may like, she said, so come by for coffee. Her apartment jumped with books, shelves of them, even in the kitchen, where we sat and drank coffee, and where I burned for her. She lent me the novel she had been reading on the park bench, Juna Barnes' Nightwood. Let me know what you think, she said. I wanted to like it because she had. I couldn't follow the story. I did not understand if there was a story, but there were passages of intense, mysterious beauty that made me tremble as if I had had my first communion. A year later, I broke my head trying to make sense of Joyce's Ulysses, another book she gave me. She had a special passion for. Something extraordinary was going on there in that Irishman's ocean of words, and I felt elevated, special, just trying to fathom it. But what remained in me was not only the novels she had led me to, but the association of fiction with sexual longing, with beauty, and with mystery. My beautiful friend loved Ulysses so much that she left her husband and children to live in Paris with a French scholar who had devoted his life to that one book. His passion to what she had also loved was the magnet. Because of her, I'm drawn to every woman I see reading a book and curious to know what she's reading, snobbishly gauging her beauty to her taste. Once, in a cafe in Paris, I saw an elegant woman, as Henry James would say, of a certain age, fixed on a book. She was at the same table over and over the following 5 days. Once our eyes met and we smiled. I took courage from that smile to approach her and ask in my most polite way, and in my crippled French, what she was reading. Nightwood, she said. That's what she was reading. And you? She asked. I held back my surprise and my wanting to tell her how I had first come across the book. But instead I answered, The Third Policeman, by an Irish writer. Oh, I'm not sure if it's translated yet, I said. I've read it in English, she said, adding, I have wondered what you were reading all these days and wondered if you were just a simpleton. She did not appear the next day or the days after, which I ascribed to my intruding on her privacy. But the head waiter, a man I had known for years and who was a friend of Lawrence Durrell's, said, she comes here every spring and every fall for 7 days and sits with a book, speaks to no one, and waits for no one. She's not French, and she's not English, and she's not American. She leaves extravagant tips above the service compris, so we don't care for how long she sits, even when we're busy. She drinks Kir Royale. Anyway, she's beautiful. I imagined her world and wrote a novel about her called The Green Hour. Excuse me. This little episode is called A Poisonous Book. A novel may just leave you where you were when you first started reading it. And in that case, it was not worth your time. The dear hours of your life never return to you. Sometimes, and in the best case, a novel leaves you with a shudder of recognition about what you do not know. It has altered you, and you do not understand how or why, but it clearly has. That does not mean it has changed you to be kinder or not to cheat on your lover or on your income taxes, but it has changed you. However alone you are, you're not alone. W.H. Auden said that poetry changes nothing but the nature of its saying. That may be true for poetry, but fiction's power moves in mysterious ways. Some novels may elevate you, some may degrade you. At 18, I encountered such a poisonous book as Weismann's novel was given to Dorian Gray by the worldly Lord Henry, as it was called then, the poisonous book. I was in my freshman year at City College and doing poorly because I arrogantly, rebelliously read everything else but the required texts. And the final exam to determine whether I was going to be expelled, which for me meant the street. I started to study 4 days before the exams. I liked the danger of it, the immersion of life at the brink's edge. Of course, I slept little and drank black coffee and smoked until my eyes popped. That was part of the ritual, but one that deranged me. The day before the exam, I lit on a copy of The Fountainhead sitting on a pile I had taken from the library. I had been warned against it by my fellow Bohemian students. It was a fascist book, an apologia for social Darwinism, an all-around rotten business with cardboard characters to boot. It didn't matter. I started reading it in the afternoon and through the night and in the morning of my first exam. I slept for 2 hours and went off to the subway and down to the college, took the exams and failed both algebra and biology. I had a semester of academic suspension to mull over my fantasy-driven crimes. What had happened? Midway in my reading of The Fountainhead, the idea grew that I was above exams, above study, towering above the college, and above every demand made on me other than my own. And soon, I was sure that I not only passed the exams, but by my powers of concentration, I would do brilliantly and with great praise. I was in the clouds of the grand self. I was like the genius architect Howard Roark, the Superman of Ayn Rand's novel. One of the exceptions for whom rules were meant to be ignored or better, to be shattered. My fellow students and my professors were the gears that made the system work, the giant academic factory that turned out standard bolts, screws, and solid citizens. I had a higher mission. I was an artist. I was the Howard Roark of the Bronx. I consoled myself with those ideas a few months after my suspension and while I was distributing mail from desk to desk in a large downtown catalog company. One more? I suppose I descend from the line of characters deluded by literature. Don Quixote, off to save chivalry in the world, modeling himself on antiquated literature of knights and their codes and adventures. The married Emma Bovary ruins her life in the pursuit of the kind of love she swoons over in the sentimental romances of her day. My model for ruin was Hemingway. Nothing he could do was wrong. Not a sentence was off. His style was contagious, and many of my generation caught the infection. I wrote shopping lists that read like this: buy a true bread. Be sure the leche is cold and container true. His stories were perfect. His life was perfect. Everything Hemingway wrote and did, I wanted to write and do, but not exactly. I did not want to fish or hunt. At 18, I went out on the day boat that sailed from Sheepshead Bay and moored some miles into the ocean. Within an hour, I turned green and spent the excursion turning even greener below deck and pretending to show to the ship's crew, as Hemingway would have had me, grace under pressure. As for hunting, at 9, I shot my Red Ryder BB gun at a squirrel squatting on my uncle's, Umberto's, little garden in the Bronx, and I missed. I hit my uncle instead. My uncle was not hurt, but the shot unsettled him, wounded his trust in me. I never again wanted to shoot at any living thing or inanimate thing. At 19, I went to the Corrida in Mexico City because of Hemingway's death in the afternoon. He had written about the drama of the run of the bulls, and I was sure I would find, as he had, the metaphysical courage acted out in the sand. But when the matador's sword plunged in and the bull fell and shuddered and died, I felt ill. I was sure, however, that the feeling would pass. as I would come to see the truth and the beauty in the bull's death and in the matador's union with the animal he had just killed. Back in my little hotel, I saw only the felled bull in the blood-soaked sand, and I had to drink a lot of tequila before I could finally go to sleep. From all of Hemingway's stories, I was especially called to action by A Clean, Well-Lighted Place, moved by its cadences and glamorous darkness. I liked the idea of a cafe bar as a place of sanctuary, and that to drink there was a mode of communication with the nothing, the nada, that the story was about in its life. I learned from Hemingway that it is the writer's task to drink. This was much easier than fishing or hunting, or even sitting alone in the total focus and purity of spirit writing. Hemingway was not all to blame for this, but he had given me a noble mission, an obligation to the profession, which I, as an earnest young man, was eager to fulfill. I was fresh from meeting Hemingway, crashing his home outside of Havana in early September of 1958. He talked about writing and its need for discipline, but he never mentioned the drinking part of the craft, which I assumed was part of the unspoken code that needed no mentioning. That fall, as one of my experiments with the writer's life and duties, I went to an Irish bar, one of the few remaining in Harlem, on my way to the morning class at City College. A long, dark bar, a bowl of hard-boiled eggs, no TV, no radio, no music, as Hemingway would have wanted it. Just me and the purity of the bar and the bartender dozing by the window on the street, and the early morning still fresh with hope. I looked at myself in the mirror and, quoting from Hemingway's story, said sotto voce, "Certainly you do not want music. Now you can stand before the bar with dignity, although that is all there is provided for in these hours." At 9, I ordered a double scotch of rye with a beer chaser, then another. I left for class feeling pleasantly woozy and glowing with dignity, but then, halfway there, I turned back for another round at the bar to secure the dignity. I missed my class that day, and the days following when I renewed the experiments, but they too failed. It took me many years beyond my adolescence and adulthood to write my shopping list straight and to cease those and other such drinking experiments. Thank you. Thank you, Brad. Thank you, Brad.